It's those two assholes. Those two idiots you saw me talking to at the third rail.
Just he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That's you've hit the third rail for sure.
That is the third rail. Saying white people have interest.
Third rail. The third rail here is good show. Another wonderful show on our on the TRS network.
And it's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
You will be destroyed.
Watch out for the third rail, baby. You saw me
talking to at the third rail.
Just, he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That's the third rail for sure.
That is the third rail. Saying white people have interest.
Good show. Another. The TRS
network. Am I hallucinating? Are we in the intro point twice? Are we live?
Yeah, we're live.
Okay, well, fuck it. We'll keep it going. Am I hallucinating? Are we in the intro point twice?
I think
my YouTube channel is muted.
It's not me. Somebody
muted it again. What? I'm just hearing it over and over.
I think okay. It seems to be okay now.
Okay. That really wasn't what we expected with the return of TV's Frank. Wow. Okay. I'm just going to go into a cold. Just as every FBI agent is a sex creep and quite possibly a fed. This is happening. It is episode 207, 207 of the most huggable Olympics-hating podcast on the air since 1973, The Third Rail. Hi, how are you? It is Spectre. We are coming to you almost live in the mobile Third Rail studio, and we are currently mobile because we are going to Taco Bell! You know, I swear to God, Sven should have a full-time job curating the best non-pause, dad-approved internet content.
I think a lot of dads in our thing, myself included as one of the dads in our thing who would very much appreciate that. Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, as you heard his voice, it is our Thought Patrol lead inquisitor and the ambassador to the turfs, Dharma King. How are you, sir?
Namaste, my nigga. Yes, doing all right. Doing all right. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a little cozy. It's going to be just the two of us, except for, despite what you may have heard at the beginning, we actually do have the glorious return of TV's Frank. How are you doing, Frank?
Graph. Collapse. Humiliation. Humiliation.
No. Borzoi is on his annual pilgrimage to the Shaolin Temple. He will be returning next week. But before we even get started, I just want to say, be sure to get vetted. We have a lot of things going on with NJP, with the pool parties. Go to TRSLmania at protonmail.com. That's TRSTLEMANANIA. Fuck it. It'll be spelled out in the show notes. You'll get it. You'll get there. But this should be episode 206.5, DK. I don't know if you know that.
You mean with the episode that shall forever be just in the archive, like deep cut archive?
No, not that one. Last week, we had internet failure. And
oh yeah, right.
Yeah, yes. And Nikkei and I did not even know about it, so we kept on for like 15 to 20 minutes. Everybody else got like it cuts off abruptly.
We
had fun. We were shooting the shit. We had no idea that we had lost the audience, lost the recording. We actually we solved for the problem of total Aryan victory, and we came up with a plan of 12 steps that will get us there by 2025.
What were the steps?
I can't remember. No.
That was like a Twilight Zone episode.
No, we had it figured out. It's back to the fucking drawing board, man.
Oh, I guess maybe that's a bad example. I didn't know that the Twilight Zone was so Jewish when Mike was doing that deep dive on that episode. I was like, oh shit. I mean, I kind of vaguely remember that Rod Serling was a Jew, but I hadn't, and I was like a fan. I liked the Twilight Zone as a kid.
Oh, sure. There's some great episodes.
Right. But then you get the one that they went through, and I was like, oh God, oh, this again. Okay, great.
I always liked the simpler ones, the ones that were like Burgess Meredith as the librarian who never had time enough to read, and then
yes,
a nuclear war comes, and he's like, finally, I have time enough to read all these books, and he breaks his reading glasses.
Yes, and To Serve Man, of course, is an all-time classic sci-fi story where, you know, it's like these aliens come, and they're like giving humanity all this technology, very kind of Ted Capel, they're giving humanity, all this technology, all this great stuff. And people are like, awesome. And like, they're giving him this book, you know, to serve man. And like, oh, they're going to help us.
Serve us. They're going to raise us up.
And then it's like, and the guy busts down the door. And he's like, it's a cookbook.
They're going to eat us. There was some good stuff that slipped in there. And,
Beholder is very non-Jewish. Very Jewish now that I think about it.
Is that the one where the all the people are ugly and she's
yes exactly it's like this whole, you never see beautiful. Anyone which is like it's a very Jewy kind of message, but it also works as conceptual sci-fi, I think, like everybody's, you know, you never see anybody's faces. This woman goes through this horrible horrific accident, and the whole episode is like basically them, you know, surgeons talking and stuff, and then finally they take the wrap off her face. You get to see her face as this amazing drop dead beautiful blonde woman. You're like, what the hell? And then they're like,
you can go live with your kind. And this handsome dude walks up, he's like, come with us.
Yeah. Which I guess there's a kind of metaphor in there too, but yeah, they show the doctors and these horrible disgusting pig alien types. It's like, oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't want to deconstruct that one because I haven't thought about it in a while. But obviously, there's a thing about, you know, universal beauty standards.
Exactly. Or that's the part that's,
I'm yeah. sure. I always look back at things with a little bit of rose-tinted glasses. But I've always pictured a lot of the content that came out of Hollywood and television, particularly the 30s and the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, like with the early 60s with the like Twilight Zone. There were certain things where obviously they were trying to be more crypto, so they would still get their paws in there, and, you know, they were planning on ramping it up, and it was just, you know, how far can we transgress? How far can we push the boundaries? It might take us a decade, but we'll get there. But in the meanwhile, good content did slip in, whether it was written in the mindset of like, let's put the goy to sleep with a good story about, you know, some episode of Bonanza or some great, film noir movie like the Big Sleep or something like that from, you know, with Humphrey Bogart. So there were, you could still pick and choose. There were things where you could find those non-pause things that really appealed to you, that really kind of got you thinking. Like, you know, there were episodes, what was one where the guys landed on what they thought was a desert planet, like they were stranded, the three astronauts, and they, as they're trying to make their way and survive, they end up killing each other, you know, out of survival mode, and then they realize they're back on Earth. They just landed in the desert.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing paused about that. That's just an interesting storytelling device that gets to human drama, and that's kind of what it's all about. But it's interesting you mentioned Twilight Zone, because I was thinking about this earlier this week, and I'm going to recount a little something I posted over on Telegram a little bit. But one of the things that they were really good at was giving you that feeling. They put you through the eyes of a character, an everyman, an ordinary guy that you could identify with, because they want to put him through these extraordinary circumstances. And so often it dealt with themes of, am I going crazy? Everything in the world around me makes no sense. Or everyone around me is blind to this thing. Or nobody can see that the king has no clothes, that the emperor has no clothes. Or that it's not a Twilight Zone story, but, you know, that Soylent Green is made of people and no one's listening. You know, those kind of stories. And I was reading how one of the worst things about the fall of the Soviet Union from a Russian's perspective during that time period, that tumultuous time period, was it was like you woke up every morning and you thought everyone around you was going crazy because all of these lies that they had been told for decades about how things were, about how things should work, just the comfort zone they had, even within a system of limitations that the Soviet Union was, they were gone. All of a sudden, all these lies they had, like Cobble's Green Grocer, and it was gone. Right. It was fucking, I mean, yes, I knew that I was lying or I was accepting a lie, but I had to do it all my life. And now that that's gone, I feel like I'm going crazy. And I feel like that's where we are now a lot of times.
I totally agree. I said this on Post the other day, but I know probably a lot of our listeners are not on Post. This is sort of a line I've been taking more recently, which is I honestly feel like I'm starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel with Clown World, which is not to say things aren't going to get worse, perhaps much worse, but I don't think that they're going to, like, in terms of the gayness specifically and the lies, it isn't even just a question of people revolting. It's really a question of just how sustainable this is, and I think we're past the point of unsustainability and at reaching the point of like the whole thing is coming unraveled, because it's one thing, like the lies that the Soviet Union was telling for the most part were things like, economic production numbers. Not to say that they didn't, I mean, they told lies about human nature as well, but it was, things about the dialectical materialism, or so this ideological stuff that didn't even necessarily have that much of a bearing on people's day-to-day lives, versus it's the official foreign policy of the United States federal government that men, you can chop your dick off and become a woman, and if you don't accept that as a foreign state, then you're going to be sanctioned. Like, that cannot persist. That's not a thing that's going to be able to continue for too much longer.
No, and hopefully, we're seeing its death throes at this point, or near its death throes. But what I was saying was, even here, once you start being red-pilled, once you start opening your eyes a little bit, you do feel like you're going crazy when you look at the world, because from the moment you wake up, from the moment your alarm clock wakes you up until the moment your head hits the pillow, everything that is presented to you from this pig American system, this society, is either a outright lie, it's contradictory to reality, or it's a lie so blatant that it's like they're smiling and telling you they're lying, but you still have to accept it.
You just have to submit to it. Vox Day, I know Vox Day gets the kind of, some of our guys like him, some of our guys are less fans. I'm a fan of Vox Day overall. I think he's worth reading and very insightful. He said something great a day or two ago, which was evil does not require our wholehearted belief or commitment. It simply requires that we submit and acquiesce. And I think that's so on point. I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. The pig American system doesn't, what allows it to remain upright for now is not that anyone actually believes in it. It's that people thus far have been willing to submit, that the price that people pay, they've judged the price of not submitting to be too high, but it's really starting to change. I wanted to highlight briefly, it was one of the things on my mind. I don't know if you want to go in this direction, we could keep it later or not at all. Oh, sorry, go on first.
I just wanted to talk about just the breadth of this the great lie. I was loath to go there. That's why I kind of stopped myself and said the great lie. I don't want to go into that bullshit, but just the absolute denial of reality that Judeo-Globo-Homo requires. The breadth of it is so wide, and it's everything from the biggest things to the tiniest. It's, well, they tell you that your most basic healthy instinct, which is like tribalism or preference for your kin and your folk and your family, is the greatest.
You don't even have to go that far. Your desire to have children. Like they've managed to pathologize, not even just, I mean, I would even say just the desire to have children is more fundamental. I mean, that's the most fundamental basic biological drive, right? Apart from just survival. But even that they've pathologized too, So
never mind all the pedo stuff, but they want you to wake up and accept that, without question, that fags butt fucking on a penis shaped pride parade float is the same thing as, you and your wife and your children and the love that you have. Love is love. Love is love. The tautology. And so it's big things like that. It's fundamental things to your identity as an American. Like, hey, you're an American. You have free speech and freedom of conscience.
Do they even use those for me? I mean, I know what you're talking. I mean, I haven't heard them talk. I haven't heard the power structure use that kind of verbiage.
Yeah.
I mean, you that's saying true. That made me
maybe that's like old fashioned, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, oh God. Now Frank is playing for our YouTube audience, for our listening audience, rather. The Frank is playing video from this. I'm like literally throwing up in my throat. I can't.
Well, that's another one. You have to accept trans women or women. That there are, doesn't matter what your biological organs are. You can be whatever you want. Or from a secular or Christian perspective, that somehow they've all been just conned to this idea that, even though that Jews killed Jesus, or that Jews spied on America, or that they drag us constantly into these wars, that somehow they're our greatest ally, that there's such a thing as more Judeo-Christian values. Or, here's another one. Picayune. Sports Illustrated covers. They're putting these fat chicks on there. Victoria's Secret. They're putting these disgusting blobs.
Didn't they?
These
I don't know what Sports Illustrated. Someone just put. I don't know, Vanity Fair. Some magazine just put like a tranny on the cover.
I think Sports Illustrated did.
It might have been. I just saw the news. And I was like, oh great, this is.
But you're supposed to accept. And it's not just that they're forcing this and telling you that you have to accept that this is a woman. They're just putting these ugly. I don't know, aboriginal weirdo fat women on there, and it's like this woman's beautiful and she's healthy at any size. Absolutely, she's healthy. You have to accept that. You have to accept common tropes like, you know, white people always want to touch black people's hair. No one believes that except for black people, but you have to accept it. You're told it. And if you say I would not want to touch a black person's hair because it's nasty, you are fired. You are excluded from society. Yeah. I mean,
the black people hair lie is one of the most egregious lies. Like, literally nobody wants to touch your hair. I don't know where this came from or why. Maybe it's just like pure projection of like, I wish people wanted to touch my hair or something. This constant thing about, I remember Steve Saylor had a thing a while back. He sort of was like, has anyone ever actually touched their hair? And he was looking at this. Surely, I mean, you know, there's got to be some kind of documentation of this. Eventually his readers were able to find there was like archival footage from 20 years ago or so, or 15 years ago, of like one person touching one black woman's hair on air. And it was like, she asked him to, basically. It was totally like not at all the kind of like, oh, excuse me, excuse you. What are you doing? Touching my, I don't know what kind of accent that was, British black person or something. Anyway.
No, but it's just everything. I mean, like, you have to, somebody pointed out what is it? 12% of the population, but literally you cannot have a movie scene, not even a movie. You can have a scene in a movie anymore without a black person in it. They've got to be in there somehow. Like, even if it's a romantic scene between a white couple, it's going to be like, I consent, I consent. Did you ask Tyrone?
Yeah. I saw an advertisement for Netflix the other day on the TV at the gym, and I was morbidly curious. It's like, okay, so how are they presenting it? And literally every single shot in from, like, I guess the series, I recognized one or two of them. I didn't recognize all of them, but I guess they were advertising, you know, their kind of Netflix original product. Every single scene in the advertisement had a black in it. I was like, obviously we know what the message is supposed to be, but I'm just wondering what's going through people's heads. Like, do foreigners, do they think that the United States is like 80% black or something?
There was like a survey of Japanese people. They said, based on just consumption of American pop culture, they estimated that the black population in the United States was about 50%.
Which, like, is honestly kind of, again, you got. I try to look past as much as it's always hard, of course, especially these days. But I as always, much as possible, I always try to take a step back and be more objective, be more analytical, and try to remove myself from the immediacy of the situation. We got some people in the chat noting that blacks are actually dropping in their populations closer to 12% now, and it's falling. Yeah. You know, the combination of basically abortion and murder in their community, and just the kind of, you know, just the general dysfunction. They've been stagnant for decades as a percentage.
Oh, we know why. I mean, between abortion and murder lower life expectancies because of all the factors.
Just general dysfunction.
We need to approach the black nationalists and explain to them that they too are victims of the great replacement.
For them.
They're being replaced just like we are. And maybe they can start pushing back.
If you extend the analysis, like, you know, you project 10, 20 years from now, this was just hilarious. I don't know if you saw, but Joe Biden, there was a clip that he said something, I think it was December or it was later, it was in the fall, around the election time-ish, and then it resurfaced maybe a month or so ago, of him basically talking to black leaders in like some kind of Zoom call or something. And he was like, look, you know, the white people percentage of the population is falling, but your percentage of the population is falling too, and you're being, you know, like, there's all these other ethnic groups that are growing and share the population, and they don't care about your people's problems. They're not going to be giving you all this welfare, so you need to get with the program.
Nice as whitey.
Right. Yeah. And
remember, there was remember those rooftop Koreans, like, and the mestizos that kicked you out of South Central.
Yeah, so that's the thing, is like, when I step back and I project out, it's like, I mean, well, the end, like, this is going to be a very, this is going to age poor, whether we're going to win, that's not really, I don't have any doubt of that.
Right.
But, like, irrespective of what that victory ends up looking like or the path that we take to get there, like, there's no scenario in which, like, even if, let's say, hypothetical, you know, total inversion, you know, Satan victory 100-0 or something, and you know, the Jews end up completely, you know, excising whites from
one of those scoreboards, like one of those scoreboard that look right. Like Rhodesians versus the Zulus.
So there's no scenario where 10, 20 years from now, even in the absence of white people, that like these Netflix commercials, people are going to look back at them like, what the hell, what was that about? Like, what, there are no yeah. black people. Like, you know, they don't do yeah. these things. Like, they don't dress like Victorian or whatever, Edwardian, you know, Regency era British people. Like, that never happened. Like, why were they making these ridiculous television programs? You know, said Juanchito to Esmeralda or whatever.
And that's two more of the great lies that you face literally every day. You know, the Netflix, you know, pushes all this garbage diversity and this black voices and all the pause stuff as well. And they say it's popular. And the critics go on Rotten Tomatoes and they tell you how great it was. And Idris Elba was just fucking awesome in this role. And I want Idris Elba to play every role now,
yeah, right.
or whatever it is. And yet the critics, they're at 90%. The actual fans, they have to like start gaming the system so that the fans can't drive down to 30% because, you know, God knows we can't have the voice of the people. We right. have to continue to present this as black replacement, black entertainment, all this gay shit and all this pause. All of this is popular. Well, why don't you release your viewership numbers?
Right.
And when I heard
that they have. Oh, Netflix. I saw Netflix is down 400,000. They lost 400,000 subscribers in the U.S.
Well, okay, subscribers. I get that. But I'd like to see actual viewership for particular
sure.
shows.
They know what. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. And you know what's in the tank, but they're just throwing good money after bad because it's not about money. It's about recasting exactly. the entire pop culture.
Control of the narrative. They don't. You know, yeah. they blast it on the TV and they control. And it's not even so right. much that this is, they don't even have to convince people per se. They just have to. It's like a meta thing. They have to convince people that this is the acceptable bounds of discourse. Like it's acceptable to have a debate. It's not acceptable. Right. Like on these terms, right?
Or just
like,
just pushing that, you know, here's Lancelot,
right?
Idris Elba as Lancelot. Yeah. Here's every white historical figure we're gonna or mythical figure or tales, you know, things that are important to us, our mythologies. Yep. Nope. Achilles, he has to be black. Nope. We're taking that away from you as well. But I guess what I was getting to with I did hear that there was actually a leak of from CBS, whatever their premium streaming is. That the third season of Star Trek Discovery, the one with the Denisha,
Dinduisha,
yeah, Blagags and the Feegs and all that. I think they said that for the entire season, and I'm not exaggerating. This is the number I heard, and it was like sourced several places, like 4,000 viewers. 4,000 viewers. By the an hour after we post this episode, we will have had more than 5,000 listens.
Yeah,
and so it's that bad, but they're just going to continue doing it. And that's what I was getting at was like the big things that were presented with from that were lied about. Think about how every day that they ever mentioned the Great Replacement theory. Think about how ham-fisted. Have you ever know? I mean, I read stories for the actual wording, and I'm trying to figure out the mindset of the writer and what the narrative that they're trying to push is beyond the story itself. And every time they mention the Great Replacement, there's always a paragraph that says the discredited white supremacist theory that has been linked to multiple violent attacks.
Right.
That blah, 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 blah. That claims that whites are being replaced through immigration and policies, sometimes directed by Jews. And I was like, So where's the lie? Of course. I can literally show you the numbers. I can literally show you the policies. I can literally show you the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society and every other Jewish refugee thing. I can show you the Hart-Celler Act and who was behind it. I can show you all of this, and you're going to still say it's a lie. And if I say, well, okay, if it's just something that's naturally happening, what if we had policies that stopped it or reversed it? You'd say, that's racist. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. These policies that you enabled are what is causing it to go this direction, so why can't it go the other direction? Why is that morally suspect? Because you hate white people and you want us gone. It's as simple as that.
Yep.
Wow, I didn't mean to get all fired up there. I don't think that Borzoi was expecting that on a show where he's not, and it's just you and me, that Havel's Green Grocer was going to come up again. So
I've been taking
my super male vitality and brain pills.
Yeah. well, I mean, you know, as a resident senior citizen, you know, I understand
Okay, I was thinking about that the other day. And if I ever take actual offense to this, it'll never stop. Yeah, we got a little echo there. A wild Jew has appeared. No, I was thinking about this. If I ever take actual offense to you guys with the senior citizen jokes, then I know that they'll never stop and they'll only get worse. But then I was also thinking, well, how could I stop this and still come across with the moral high ground? And I was like, you know, disrespect to your elders, disrespect to the village wise men, those who have survived the battles and not died at the ripe old age of 26. In white societies, they're revered. Nay, honored. Nay, placed upon pedestals. So I question the white European lineage of all who would question their elders and their divine wisdom. And hang on a second. Nurse, can I have another pill? and therefore, I question your whiteness, DK, and Borzois as well.
Well, I mean, we are, you know, respectively, we are Indian and Chinese. So, I mean, you know.
So, oh, that's right. Did you enjoy butt-breaking all those blacks in South Africa last week?
Yes, it was very fun. I like to make them get down on the ground on all fours.
Dude, that's, I mean, I think we found our mercenary corps in the future ethno wars. That are in a book I'm writing.
I mean, the guy going like, "Die, you mother! Die, fuck, die!"
You're fuck your shit, man. You come to my neighborhood. I will fuck your balls. I will fuck your balls in your ass.
Yeah.
Well, you had some prep. I got a little bit, but since we're kind of taking it easy, anything you want to particularly talk about, or do you just want to go into?
Well, I mean, not. I mean, so I got a couple things. If we're gonna go with, like, the winners losers topic route, which I know, I mean, we're now, you know, show starts. What is this, like?
Yeah,
for 30 minutes, but 30 minutes. I mean, my winner was gonna be Stonks. My loser was gonna be Japan,
mm-hmm.
and my topic. I mean, my first topic that I wanted to talk about. Was death in the context of COVID, but I was sort of like doing, you know, last minute, like, I wonder what Tablet Mag, I wonder what's going on at Tablet Mag, and they got a hilarious long, these just in like these interminable things, and just, like, you know, tens of thousands of words or something. But anyway, anorexia and the Holocaust is kind of a funny article. So I mean, if we want to have like a bit of sort of comic relief, that's another direction we could go.
Okay. I had really the big thing I had was, I don't know if it's what you want to call it, bias confirmation. One of those where the writer is right for the wrong reasons, or they're right and somebody just needs to say, "You're right. What you just said doesn't shame me. In fact, I embrace it." So, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I got that. Oh, we were talking about, I don't know, at some point before we started, you and I were talking about, you know, creating the quality content and all that.
Yes.
And why that's important to the movement in the bigger picture. And let's definitely circle back to that once we get through some of this, because I think that's a kind of a bigger picture important. And I actually want to encourage that, because I've got a couple of things I'm, debating. And I know that you have a creative mind and a creative, streak and things that you're working on. And, you know, there's more than polemics, and there's more than, racist podcast. Yeah, of course. But, like, even like at one point I was like, I should sit down and write some kind of like fan service for our guys fiction that, you know, it would be serviceable. It would, you know, kind of reinforce some of our ideas. It would be like a kind of a soulless adventure novel, a Jack Ryan type thing, but, you know, from a white nationalist perspective. I'm like, nah, that's garbage. Maybe somebody else in somebody's better hands, a story like that can be told, and that's something we need within the sphere of the content that we create. But it actually drove me to start thinking about a story that I've kind of had in the back burner. It's like it's kind of a collection of stories. You know, just looking at what the future might hold, but from a very individual emotional perspective of the people involved, rather than, you know, like any action, anything about the future collapse or where America is in 20 or 30 years is all in the background. It's really about the relationships. And I don't know if I'm up to the task, but it's definitely something I want to try. And it's a passion.
I would very much look forward to that. Yeah. I mean, I know Mike and Sven have said this before, and I want to throw my voice into the chorus of saying, yeah, we need more fiction, more original stories, right. more you know, artistic productions of all sorts. I think, you know, and Borzoi to this point has said before, and I agree, which is that has to be good art first. And sort of, you know, ideological second. If you make it ideological first, it's going to suck. Yep. The thing I want to add, the only point I would add to that as far as like a kind of nuance is I'm increasingly fond of the formulation, like, reality has a fascist bias. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that means is that, like, to the extent that good art, good fiction, good storytelling, is good because it is a good mirror to reality. It is true. It has a deep, you know, mythopoetical, psychoanalytic truth to it. Mm-hmm. Because of that, then the story itself will reflect our principles, our values, right? And mm-hmm. so you don't like it, it. The better a story is, the more that it's going to do that kind of naturally. And you see that even in you know, good fiction or better fiction, you know, fiction that isn't terrible, even from libtards. Mm-hmm. We just recorded and released yesterday an episode of the Culture Terror podcast we do with on the Harry Potter series, and it was one of the sort of points that I made, and it always struck me that, like, you know, Harry Potter, one of the ways to look at, I mean, one of the things that I always kind of hated about it, I read it as when I was younger, and I enjoyed certain things about it, but I kept waiting for certain kind of character arcs to resolve in ways that I thought were, like, kind of mythopoetically required, in particular regarding, like, Draco's character arc. I kept waiting for him to kind of grow up and throw off the shackles of his, you know, his father and his family, and to have some kind of satisfying character resolution, which never came. And it occurred to me that part of what was going on, or part of the problem with the series, is like, J.K. Rowling is a good enough writer and an astute enough observer of human nature that, you know, her story resonates with a lot of people because she's tapping into, you know, European cultural consciousness, blood memory, and relying on these archetypes. But that comes with certain kind of fascist baggage, for lack of a better word. I mean, it's just, like, naturally a certain way. Yeah. And so she has to kind of sand away, like with the goblins, of course, and we talk about that a little bit, but she has to, you know, twist and turn and sand away the edges and constantly kind of pull her punches and do stuff to kind of try to make those fascist, the elements, not so prominent in her story. Whereas, like, you know, if you read, like, I'm about halfway through now with Marty's book, and I'm very much enjoying it, and we'll be doing that again soon. I know there's a hyper podcast episode, hyper podcastism, I think one of the things that's so great about it is you know, he's okay if you know the mean speak and you know the lingo. If you know the lingo, then you can recognize all this stuff. But it's also just a good story, and it's not on, like, an ideological track. He has people talking ideologically, you know, characters, but it's not the artistic value.
It's characters. It's as much a character study as anything. It's got depth and emotion to it. But again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, like, there's content that you can find from the, you know, going back to even the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, even more recent stuff that you can find, you know, the reason you can still find content that, you know, is coming from Hollywood, that, you know, has a pause message somewhere buried in it, or that has maybe some element that's off-putting, but the rest of it's good. It's because they're, you know, when they're trying to create a good story, the best of them will work on the story first, and then they'll put their paused bullshit in afterwards. Just like you said, that's why you still have good memories of movies that might have a something that's antithetical to your worldview. I mean, it's simple as that. It's just a good story or an interesting character. So there's that. But anyway, I didn't want to get too far down the rabbit hole here, but I guess I just wanted to encourage anyone in our thing, whatever your medium is, to just. There's low-hanging fruit to be had if you're a little too on the nose, but if you just put yourself, you know, throw it into your passion, into something that you really care about, and just let it come from an honest place within you, then your worldview, your politics, your, you know, the things that you believe in your core is going to come out in that, if that makes any sense at all.
Of course, of course.
And that's what I guess what I was going for. It was, as soon as I finished this other project I'm working on, I was debating two different story ideas that I was like, for fiction, that I was like, this one is going to, it'll be a little bit of work, but it won't be that hard and it'll be serviceable, but eh. And then I was like, this one I've had in my back of my mind for probably since I got into this thing, that a story can be told in a certain way about the future, that, you know, the near future, that gets across these ideas, but without, I mean, like if you were just an ordinary person reading, you'd be like, oh, interesting story. I hope if I'm up to the task. So I'm just encouraging, whether you're, I don't care what your medium is, whether it's writing or any, you know, music or other kinds of art. I don't know much about art. Grug, no art. I'm just saying, get out there.
I actually think that the Grug approach to visual art is the best. Like, if it's pretty, everybody knows that it's pretty and we can all appreciate it. It doesn't have to be like, I mean, there's, you know, we can talk about certain kinds of aspects of refinement. You don't have to like ask, you know, like, is a Caravaggio or a Rembrandt like a great work of art? You look at it like, oh shit, that's awesome. Like,
you know, yeah.
There's no, like, all that's very, like, all that modernist shit, that's just, like, I mean, that's not to say that there aren't some, you know, intellectual directions you can go with it, but for the most part, the Grug approach to visual art is the correct one.
Yeah. Well, whether you think it comes from your divine spark or just your nature itself, you know, the very blood that flows in your veins, you know, you recognize beauty and you recognize somehow at the fundamental Grug level that beauty means good. But there is a virtue in beauty.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, what they're so concerned to tear down the very concept of beauty, you know, fat acceptance and all these heinous, disgusting trannies running around and you know, like, just the concept. I've seen a little bit of this. It hasn't been emphasized, but I'm waiting for, like, Because at the end of the day, like, you know, intelligence, they can sort of do all sorts of funny things about and come up with all kinds of, you know, justifications and ad hoc reasons why, especially in the aggregate, you know, we don't have to accept certain things. But the, you know, there's all kinds of studies about things like height, like the more, basically the taller and more attractive you are, the, you know, the better off you have it, everything else being equal. And oh, yeah. And that's a really robustly established result. And so I'm just waiting for, like, beauty privilege to be, you know, the we're close there. I think that and pedophilia are going to go hand in hand ultimately.
Yeah, beauty privilege, along with the tearing down of the white European patriarchy beauty standards that were forced upon people. Because normally anybody in the world would look at, you know, 300-pound Aboriginal woman and, you know, a little Swedish girl in a wheat field and say, you know, I could take either one. You know, that looks good. Whatever. Whoever's available. This is not going to happen. Speaking of anorexia, beauty standards, you did have something on that issue.
Yeah, so if you want to, we could let's take a look at this, because this is just, I don't even know, like, what... Well, let's just start reading. So here's from Tablet Magazine.
Can we just preface this with, we did solve the question of, you know, why are women? And the answer is no. Is there anything, I mean, we already know that women are ungoverned children. You can't let them think too many thoughts at one time in this sense. And then when you have a Jewish woman who's obsessed about her looks and the natural neuroticism and narcissism and just all these, this confluence of madness, brings us to this article. I just wanted to kind of set the stage and, you know, like, you know, introduce the players, roll out the props, because this is peak Judaism right here. I just wanted, you found a good one.
Yeah, this is fantastic. So here we go. Anorexia and the Holocaust by Julie Goldberg. If you look underneath,
oh, God!
If you look underneath the tweets of Eugenia Cooney, a popular fashion YouTuber whose increasingly thin appearance in her videos has garnered intense public attention, I citation needed on that, but whatever, let's take it. Okay, fine, I guess. You'll see replies rife with Holocaust comparisons. Some tell her, so just, I want to set the stage here. There's a fashion YouTuber who's getting thinner, and some people in the comment section have said some stuff about the Holocaust, and this is like cause for this woman to write several thousand words of kvetch. Some tell her she is, quote, like an emaciated Holocaust victim, or indeed, quote, skinnier than actual Holocaust camp victims. I bet that's true.
Hey, baby. Hey, baby, how's your typhus?
Others offer quips such as, you're cosplaying Holocaust victims, or, quote, oh, wow, is it Holocaust Memorial Week already?
I'm sorry. That was perfect.
No, it's good. It's funny, man. Under one particularly alarming photo, one user writes, quote, Jewish girl after Holocaust, colorized 1945.
Oh, my God.
As it happens, the Holocaust survivor comment.
And the Jimmies were rustled.
I know, right? You can just imagine how, like, the activation of the almonds going on in Julie Goldberg's mind. As it happens, the Holocaust survivor comment and its myriad variants abound not only across Eugenia's, but also any visibly anorexic girl's social media feeds. One wonders whether the comment is intended for the anorexic girl herself to shock her into recovery or shame her for promoting harmful, quote, thinspo content. I guess that's, yeah, thinspiration, right? It's like to get them thinner. Or if it is...
Oh, like don't give up there, baby, kind of like posters or... What, encouragement to lose weight?
Yeah. Like, I think this is a thing. I vaguely recall having read in the past about this, where like anorexics online will encourage each other to continue to like get more emaciated, and they call this thinspiration or thinspo. It's a very sick subculture, obviously. Anyway.
Oh, okay. I see. I got it backwards. I thought it was like some kind of fat shaming, but I see.
No, it's like you're.
Wait a minute! Don't these people identify as fat?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
It's a basic bitch take, but it's kind of
there.
They think
they're fat. They have a basically completely warped self-image, and so, but they want to continue to lose weight, and so they're like trying to egg each other on to continue to lose weight.
Okay, I actually want to go a little bit deeper with this real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be easy. The easy pickings is the pointing out the hypocrisy of, you know, well, if she identifies as thin, then who's to say that she's not, and we should affirm her, just like if you identify as a woman and you're a man.
Well, that's actually, I mean, that's a natural comparison.
It's you know, that's an easy pickings with the hypocrisy point, but actually when you think about it, it actually applies 100. It's a one-to-one analogy, because in their minds, an anorexic person believes that they are fat, and they therefore self-harm to attain what they consider their ideal weight. It's a body dysphoria kind of a thing. How is that any different than, you know, looking in the mirror and saying, I need to chop off my dick to be a proper person? I'm not in the right body.
It's not. And the tranny community has had fights about this, both with anorexics and with, I forget what they call themselves, but there's this subculture of people who seek voluntary, medically unnecessary amputations because their body image is like, I'm a quadriplegic or whatever. You know, I'm a double amputee, or I'm an amputee. Like, my body image is like, I'm missing my one leg below the knee and my other leg like above the knee. So they seek out some so-called doctor to like cut off
unscrupulous sawbones
to do that. And like, this is a obviously a problem for the whole, like, the entire analytic framework of such as it is for transgenderism. Is like, well, if these people have a valid body image, and we're, you know, on what basis are we going to deny them amputation of healthy limbs and give you, you know, your gender confirmation surgery, right? It just doesn't make any sense.
I said last week that there's a beast in my chest called FedPost that lives and lurks. And when you think about, this is not just, oh, these are wacky people doing some weird thing. Think about the community of doctors, so-called doctors, that are actually in the business to amputate. Forget the trans thing. That you go to them with a mental illness where you want your legs cut off, they cut away healthy flesh. This is not just, oh, they're violating the Hippocratic. This is demonic. These are monsters. These are people convincing people that it's okay to mutilate and torture their bodies in ways that I don't think that a medieval inquisitor would have, you know, thought was acceptable. I mean, there were actual rules during the Inquisition that you couldn't break skin, and that so-called torture could only last like 15 minutes once or twice a day. I mean, there were some actually strict rules on how much harm could be done. There's a medical community, there's a psychological community, there is a psychotic social media support community for people. Or to prop up an industry that literally mutilates human beings. You're born a male in the West. They want to mutilate your genitals right from the start, and now they've expanded their mutilation and I mean, how are these people not considered ghouls? Every one of them, from the psychologists to the surgeons to whomever, anyone involved in this enabling it, how are they not considered fucking demonic ghouls and monsters that should be, with due process, removed from society?
Yes, physically removed, so to speak. You control.
And they dare fucking slander Dr. Joseph Mengele for his experiments to save lives and all the treatment he did for these people. I mean, they are literally the embodiment of what they project onto Dr. Goebbels. I mean, Dr. Mengele.
Yep.
And you see it in their movies. You see it in the torture porn movies. Saw, Saw was a little bit psychological, but you know, like the hostile movies. All, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I could never watch those. It doesn't do anything for me.
No, it doesn't appeal to me either. But my point is that's
yeah. But you see, that's what they make. That's what they try to. Yeah. That's what they push. That's what they try to get to be popular. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I kind of wonder why they haven't done. Now that I think about it, with the exception of like U-Bowl, there hasn't been any movies about the Holocaust where they're just explicitly showing, like probably since Schindler's List, the actual, you know, a lot of the claimed atrocities. It's more, I don't know, it's been like stuff like more psychological, like Zookeeper's Wife, some of these, the more psychological Holocaust dramas, rather than showing it. I wonder if, at least in part, it's not like, because they see how people react to Schindler's List, some of those scenes where they're kind of like laughing at them or like going, you know what? I wonder what they did to deserve this. I wonder if they're a little bit worried about that. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. Anyway, I have derailed you totally.
It's all right. It's fine.
Sorry. Keep going.
This is a Anyway, so and also I just wanted to highlight Flavortown resident in the chat had a great comment. The 6 million lost calories, which A plus.
Okay.
My friend.
Yeah, that may be the shit.
So, I'll skip ahead just a little bit. So. As it happens, the Holocaust survivor comment and its myriad variants abound not only... Oh, yeah, I said that. Our difficulty in pinpointing precisely why this is grossly inappropriate raises the question of where our concern actually lies. Is it the fragile psyche of the anorexia sufferer we are worried about? Or is it the inviolate memory of the Holocaust we seek to protect? Might it be a mix of the two? What is more surprising is how frequently the Holocaust survivor comparison is made in medical guidebooks and scholarly journals, and even in the first-hand accounts of anorexia sufferers and their families. When it is not being lobbed as an insult, the term, quote, Holocaust survivor and its variants are often used as a barometer of the severity of the illness. In comparing the anorexic individual's body to that of a person who has been subjected to the most abject human suffering imaginable, the speaker makes it clear that this body is in grave distress and in need of intervention. While these comparisons are less frequent, also wait, just pause. I mean, I know this is, you know, it's everybody, it's somebody's first show, I guess. Everybody has a first show that they listen, and if this is your first show listening, I want to let you know that these photos you've seen, you know, these torture porn that you've been subjected to, psychological conditioning of you know, emaciated by the quote Holocaust bodies that they're referring to, that sort of we all take it for granted in this discussion. These are people who are starving because the Allies bombed the supply lines. It says this was not torture. This was not deliberately inflicted on the interned population. This was the direct result of Allied war efforts targeting German supply lines. And yeah, under conditions of war, you know, you have an interned enemy population. You know, people, you're not killing them. That's a lie. That's a slander. But you are interning them, just as the Americans did to the Japanese and even some Germans.
And of course, at the end of the war, when the supply lines break down, when food is scarce, when German civilians and soldiers are starving, and typhus breaks out everywhere, don't be surprised when there are casualties.
Or people starving. Like, yeah, Germans were starving too. You know,
the British and the Americans were the minds behind the concept of total war, where nothing was off limits, where cities could be bombed at will, and they did so over the course, you know, terrible.
And they argued about it at the time. Over the course of years. The concept of strategic bombing. The Germans did not develop a strategic bombing doctrine. So strategic bombing is where you bomb civilian population centers under the theory that the civilians are contributing to the war effort.
Right.
This was debated among the military staff in the United States government, I believe in the United Kingdom government, but I'm not as up on that.
They were the authors of the idea of total war.
Well, they argued about it, and in the aftermath, they were like, it didn't work. It didn't actually. Right. It basically, they just rebuilt the factories. That didn't actually harm production at all. It was a total waste. But they kept doing it anyway. Exactly.
And then they made it worse with the firebombing of Dresden. I guess my point being that if you declare total war on a nation and suddenly their entire economy and food supply system and everything else breaks down to the point where people are dying of starvation or disease outbreaks, it kind of is on you at that point. Because you didn't have, even in the worst days of like maybe the Blitz, maybe this isn't a good comparison, but you know, because the type of tactical bombing the Germans were doing, you didn't have starving British children. You know, they weren't, you know, doing what the Germans
were doing. The Blitz was a terror campaign, but it wasn't
absolutely.
But it wasn't like it wasn't resulting in starving out the British population, nor was that the intent.
No.
In any case, we'll continue. So while these comparisons are less frequent in contemporary texts, they are far from uncommon in those of the later 20th century, particularly the 1980s, when scholarly as well as popular interest in anorexia proliferated. A father's cautionary tale, published in a 1984 issue of The Guardian with the headline...
Can I ask you something? If full Jews get anorexia and from dealing with this, do Mischlings get inorexia? Sorry, I stole that from Nick Ryder in the chat.
Good stuff. That's hilarious. Describes the titular the trouble with a middle class brat. Describes the titular brat as looking increasingly like a concentration camp victim, an impression she heightened by having her hair almost shaved off. Okay, because clearly there's something mentally wrong with this person. And anyway, so
here's a person. I haven't read the details. Let's just assume this person is suffering mental illness, needs help. Yeah. This Jew has to make it all about her.
Exactly. Well, and that's what's going on here, right? Fundamentally, yes.
Mm-hmm.
A year later, Dr. Ira L. Mintz referred to anorexia patients as self-made.
Oh God! Somebody call my caddy. I'm going to be late to the tee off.
Concentration camp victims, implying at once that they are victims of their own minds, as well as a kind of a counterfeit of the real thing, appropriating the physical characteristics of one who has suffered tremendously without enduring that same degree of suffering themselves. The stereotype of the anorexic individual, indeed, is the girl who has been brought up with all the comforts and privileges one could desire, facing no hardship from the external world. She elects to persecute herself and thus enacts an ironic inversion of the self-made success. In her seminal, if now outmoded, 1985 text, The Hungry Self, Kim Chernin cites the frequency of Holocaust comparisons in the families of others. That's a C-H-E-R-N-I-N. I believe that's a Jewish surname as well. She provides testimony from a mother likening her 20-year-old daughter to those pictures of people just liberated from Buchenwald, which Buchenwald was not even alleged to have been an extermination camp, of course, as well as another woman who can't bear to look at her younger sister as she looks like a death's head, like one of those people the Nazis tried to starve to death. I thought they were all gassed. I thought that... people don't even...
They were all shot, and then they were gassed, and then they were starved.
Right.
Buried... dug up,
and then
burned,
up and
shot again, burned again, and then they gassed the remains. I think that was the order.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Only if you follow that logical chain of events does the entire narrative make sense.
For these family members, the comparison bespeaks estrangement from the girl they once knew. It is an attempt to communicate what they feel in their hearts, that she is simply not herself. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit. What these comparisons and their critics seem to disregard, however, is the possibility that it is not always a coincidence that anorexic individuals can be said to resemble Holocaust survivors. For those with ties to the Holocaust, this resemblance merely makes legible an involuntary inheritance of a body impressed with pain. And here's, this is like the shot, essentially, just like, you know, maybe the, I don't know how much more of this I can really stomach, but basically what they're, decades of research have shown that Holocaust-related trauma is passed down to the second and third generation.
Oh,
and
my
has
God.
Untold psychological effects.
Dude.
No,
time out. I remember seeing tweets about this for the first time within like 2 years ago. Like, fucking crazy, you know, Jewish women on Twitter were suggesting that they might have second or third degree generation Holocaust survivors.
A 2015 study from Mount Sinai Hospital, for example, found that the children of Holocaust survivors, compared to Jews whose parents lived outside of Europe during World War II, expressed notably higher levels of a gene associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. The answer to whether this traumatic inheritance might articulate itself through disordered eating habits can be found in clinical studies, population-based surveys, and first-hand accounts alike, with the latter sending the most unequivocal message. First-hand accounts, that is, sending the most...
This is like...
Holocaust trauma has affected successive generations' relationship with food and their bodies in complex and life-altering ways.
If I had a time machine, boys with a time machine...
Yeah.
Boys with the time machine, I'd go back to 2016 and announce to all of our guys, guys, Tumblr is real. Destroy it now. Because it's going to become your reality within 5 years.
So I mean,
Jesus,
so just to be clear, like, because she never quite comes out and says, I mean, this is like already we're like, well, you know, 2,000 words or so into this.
I just want to throw one logical question in here about the just the assertion that the second and third generation Holocaust survivors are showing these PTSD markings. I think I read the other day that there are fewer than I think maybe 1,000. Maybe the number's around there, but it's a very small number of World War II veterans who actually fought in the war who are still alive. I'm not talking about people who lived during the war, or even talking about people who were served in the military but were rear echelon, but of those who actually were deployed to combat units, whether in the Pacific or Europe, there are, you know, just a minuscule number left. You know, like the youngest one would have been born in, what, 1928? So they're all in their 90s. You know, and yet for some reason there seems to be a growing number of first generation Holocaust survivors. like I remember in 2010 seeing headlines where they were saying like there are fewer than 150,000 Holocaust survivors left. How can we tell their stories? You know, standard Jewish Daily Forward type story. Flash forward like 5 years and they're like, there are only 250,000 Holocaust survivors still alive. You can support them for $10 a month. You can send these people money in Israel. You know what I'm saying? The number keeps growing. So if they went through all this trauma of being in a concentration camp where they were supposedly beaten and starved and tortured and suffered deprivations and environmental deprivations and cold and disease and dysentery, how come they're outliving guys who of the same period who fought and actually did experience trauma? The trauma of combat. It seems like there's something amiss there. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, obviously, I mean, you know, the point has been made before, but a quote Holocaust survivor is just a Jew who was alive at any time.
During the Holocaust,
I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, basically,
in Tierra del Fuego,
between 1933 and 1945, like if you were alive, you are.
I am Jew. I existed. I lived in Anchorage. I am a Holocaust survivor.
Exactly. So there's that. Beyond that, of course, it's just, you know, it's just ridiculous. And this is where I wanted to go with this too, is Leonard Swartzen, says exactly the right thing, which is this is Lamarckism for Gibbs. For those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, Lamarckism is a wrong biological genetic theory that it's basically making the claim, the false claim, the argument that, that interventions on the parent have a genetic effect on the child. You know, we like to talk about blood memory. I talked about it earlier in this show. I actually, you know, there's an extent to which you don't necessarily be 100% against like the entirety of that kind of a framework, but the famous Lamarck experiment was chopping the tails off of 50 generations of mice. So for 50 generations, he chopped the tail off, chopped the tail off, chopped the tail off, waiting for a mouse to be born with no tail, and obviously it never happened because that's not how any of this works.
Right.
And so this is like a completely discredited, completely insane, divorced from reality type of approach to the question of like, which is all just in the service of like, there's this problem of like, Jews are the wealthiest group in the world, and in the United States, both. They occupy incredible seats of power and money and privilege, and they operate this criminal network of ethnic privilege and nepotism. But you know, their psychological well-being depend. You know, they have this intense ethnic paranoia, I would say it's, I mean, it's, you know, we know the high rates of schizophrenia and so on. It's definitely at least a part result of their inbreeding and just general kind of racial character is they're extremely paranoid. And second, so it's not, but it's not even just that it's a question of their self-image. It's that this is the source of their power, right? And within right. this victim worshiping society, that they've managed to set up is that power derives from, you know, this victimhood, mm-hmm. socially sanctioned victimhood. So the question is, how do, you know, when all of the, anyone who is, not even just like in any of the internment camps, but anyone who was alive, you know, in 1945, when all the people, anyone who was born in 1945 or earlier, when they're all dead, right? And there are no more quote, first generation quote, Holocaust survivors. What are you going to do? Because now you're in a situation where like, there's no one with any living memory of it. Everybody was, you know, born after the fact and they all have incredible wealth and power. In the aggregate, how do you justify the you know continued deference paid to the Jews?
Oh yeah,
and the answer.
Well, that's why they're so desperate here. But
yeah, exactly.
I like the way you summed this up. That's exactly where we are and what's ahead. So keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No, it's fine. Yeah, but this is the one strategy that they're adopting. And so the argument here is just to kind of spell it out because she doesn't quite. She never quite completely does it. Is what they're saying is like okay, little Rachel, little or whatever I don't know what's a good Johanna, little Johanna Schmuelsberg, you know her grandfather quote survived the quote Holocaust. You know, she doesn't have any memory of it. She was born decades after the fact. Her parents were born after the fact. But you know, her grandfather, you know, transited through, you know, Treblinka on the way to wherever, and this is, you know, quote surviving the quote Holocaust, right? Mm-hmm. Well, her does that, and actually, I had some Jewish friends in college. I know I'm a
Torah. Oh God,
oh God,
yeah, right. get out, beware, remove yourself from my presence.
What's funny
No, I'm kidding.
As in a side note on this, like actually that was around the time when a lot of this trauma stuff was initially getting developed. One of my Jewish friends in particular, I remember, was sort of starting to get involved in this trauma studies. And this was, I'm not going to say when exactly, but this was a while ago. And I mean, earlier than you would think, I guess. And when I was speaking with her about this, like, it came up because I was sort of doing some I had started kind of asking these questions about these things. I, you know, my almonds had been activated because it was the roughly, let's say, the era of the Second Intifada and the Iraq War, and it was very clear to me that Israel was behind it. And so I was kind of interested in looking into all these issues, and I learned in the course of my research that there's a very, very high prevalence among actual first generation, you know, Holocaust, like Jews who were in the internment camps, that they're total assholes, that these are the most abusive, just horrible people. They have, you know, they beat their children.
I'm glad what you're saying went there, because I was wondering the same thing. But keep going.
So my Jewish friend that I had at the time was like, I was asking about this, because I was like, you know, because she said something about like working, you know, learning about trauma studies and stuff. I was like, yeah, you know, I remember reading something about how you know the people, like the grandparents now essentially, who were actually in these camps, you know, they're just horrible people often. And she's like, yeah, you know, and actually a lot of my friends have this experience of basically being beaten and abused and psychologically abused, and these people are just really mean, nasty people. And then that becomes a source. Her angle on it at the time was that becomes a source of resentment in the family, not so much of any of this kind of epigenetic or Lamarckian stuff, but more because it's like, okay, you picture yourself, you're the child of the so-called Holocaust survivor, right? Like you are told that this person survived this horrible, horrible ordeal. You're in the Jewish community. They like you owe them a position of deference. They're like the holiest thing in this community, right? Because they're this living symbol of this thing that defines Jewish identity. Jews don't believe in God; they believe in the Holocaust. That's a robust, you know, that they much more Jews,
and their heaven, like, is nothing.
Yeah. Right. So on the one hand, they're like they're taught, you know, we have to respect this person, we have to revere this person. This person is sacred. On the other, the actual person themselves is a horrible, abusive, nasty, you know, piece of work, and it causes them, like, the children then psychological problems, and then the grandchildren psychological problems, as you can imagine. That kind of,
I guess my Greg reaction when I heard a lot of this and what you're saying is it does just naturally follow. It's, I mean, they say that these second, third generation people have these genetic markers for showing PTSD, but how do we know that that's not just natural? I mean, right, like you said, the people who were actually put into the camps were, by, it seems by logical inference, were probably the most problematic. The ones that really stuck out like sore thumbs. The ones that were the troublemakers. The ones that were these neurotic, nebbish, interfering, undermining people. And so if they did, quote unquote, survive the Holocaust and then had children, their children are going to be like that. It feels like they've got the cause and effect here backwards. Like somebody says to you, let me example, you'll know, DK, because I know you have your fedora and your katana, but, you know, like the first time you hold a well-made sword in your hand or a well-made pistol, like, not that I know anything about anybody who would hold a gun, but you say, oh, you know, you can just tell that we were evolved for this kind of violence because how natural this feels in my hand. And it's like, no, boner. Centuries have been developed to try to make the handle and the weight of that sword, you know, ideal for a human hand. It's not that, you know, you're getting cart before horse. And like you said about blood memory, you know, and comparing it to the whole the chopping of the tails off the generations of mice, it's like we're not seeing that something happened in some ancestors' experience that somehow is passed down on to us or whatever. But when we talk about, like, the blood memory of the European man, of those who look to the West, look to the horizon, who have that adventurous spirit, or those who naturally can take command and or work together in a patriarchal system under the adverse conditions of the European ice age and all the hard scramble living for the, you know, 100,000 years before. Those people are the ones who survived. The ones who didn't have that did not. And so passed down to, you know, what we would consider blood memory today is, you know, when you feel that same kinship to looking out upon, looking at the horizon and wanting to conquer it, looking to your fellows that you have kinship with and knowing that there's a certain order. It's because that was what was passed down to you. It's not because you remember what Grandpa Grug said or saw. And that's the inversion of the very concept of science and genetics and all that they have to put forward to get this idea that we can have a Holocaust forever, infinity Holocaust, the infinity and the Holocaust anorexia diet. We can have all of this and we can market it that way forever because we're just going to lie to you about how things work.
Yeah, I mean, if you can have second and third generation trauma, quote unquote, why not fourth and fifth and sixth and 6 millionth exactly. generation trauma, right? This is just another strategy for Jews to assert eternal dominance over the rest of humanity.
And can I say that?
Yeah, please.
What I just posited was kind of again the Grug take on how things, you know, how humanity has developed. It will surprise you to know that I'm actually not a practicing anthropologist. But this is just a broad holistic theory that I was positing there, or you know, just I guess I'm just like looking for the patterns and I'm seeing them. We're good at that.
Yep, I mean that's how we got here. I mean, yeah,
no kidding.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know, the rest of the article is quite meandering and doesn't really like go into. Let me read the last paragraph just to kind of sum it up, I guess. This is Julie Goldberg writing. My point is that while surface level comparisons between the Holocaust and anorexia are indeed crass and trivializing, we also do ourselves a disservice when we act as if the two have nothing to do with one another. Ultimately, the individual in the throes of anorexia does resemble a Holocaust survivor. The self-sameness of starvation's physical presentation is unsettling because it effaces the psychological aspects of starvation, but it is also what has allowed for the transference of medical knowledge from World War II starvation studies to anorexia nervosa research. This history is erased, and the suffering of the Holocaust is trivialized each time it is cited simply out of convenience.
I was just going to say, none of this would be a problem. The idea that the average person would look at a picture of a anorexia victim and automatically start making Holocaust jokes or references, none of this would be a problem had the Jewish controlled educational system not made it a priority for children as, you know, young as kindergarten, much less, you know, older, have to be inundated with these god-awful, traumatizing pictures of the alleged Holocaust at the youngest age, so it's burned into their memories that this is the ultimate evil. This is the worst thing you can possibly see. And this is long before that they're desensitized to gore on 4chan. You know, these are children, you know, innocent children, and the first thing they see is these stacked bodies. You know, these typhus victims.
The thing about that too is,
and they're told all these murder things in ovens and all this.
Under conditions of industrial agriculture, like famine isn't a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, you could easily imagine. I mean, I'm sure you could find pictures from. There have been other famines, you know. I know in China they've had famines, and obviously the Holodomor and various other things. You know, you can find pictures of starving people, sure, other than those pictures of starving people. But those, as with everything else, you know, those are the only pictures of starving people that you get exposed to. And you know, when, at least for now, the supply lines are functioning, and we have fertilizer and industrial agriculture and supply lines and just-in-time delivery, and, you know, everybody's like, you know, the problem of poverty historically throughout, you know, tens of thousands, I mean, go back to amoebas, right? Like, the problem is getting enough to eat, getting enough calories. And it's only very, very recently, really within, basically since the end of the Second World War, roughly, that's been essentially a solved problem.
We have the opposite problem.
And now we have the opposite problem where, you know, historically poor people didn't have enough to eat. Now they have too many calories, too many crappy calories in their fat.
They're the most obese,
right,
segment of the population.
So, you know, that people lose their ability to, like, sort of contextualize, you know, when you see a starving body. Obviously you go to the Holocaust because you've been propagandized to think in those terms, but also because that's the only thing that's the only reference in a sense that you have. I mean, when was the last time I haven't seen a starving, like a physically starving person ever, I don't think, you know, and I've been to some pretty poor places, not just in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it's, it's really evil. I mean, we've said this before, but, if, you know, again, it's everybody's first show is everybody's first show. Like, it's really, really evil the way that they condition people in this way. It's just disgusting.
Yeah,
I agree.
Well,
and now to sort of, like, do this weird, I mean, I guess she's a terror. It says that Miss Julie Goldberg here is a New York based writer currently completing her master's degree at the University of Cambridge.
I'm sure she has a lot of opinions that I'd love to hear about. That,
well, the funny thing
really
is, this
blow my mind,
so,
or change so me, or inspire, like, me.
It sounds like
possibly make me kill myself.
It sounds like she struggles with anorexia. She didn't say this, but it sounds like she struggles with anorexia and the feelings of guilt associated with it, because she has, you know,
she believes in the
myth of the Holocaust.
Dude, and you can make that assumption based on the fact that this is the article she wrote.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, just that alone.
But she never talks about it, which is like, okay, so then what are you talking? And she goes on all these weird tangents about, you know, like, you know
the saying, if you see it, it's for you. If you write it, it's about you.
That
with women writers, Steve Saylor said it best. The entirety of women's journalism in modern America is to basically assert that once the revolution comes, they will be considered attractive. Whatever their flaw is,
they'll be considered hotter. Yeah, that's exactly Saylor's law of female journalism is un. There's no exceptions, zero. Nope.
Woman decides to write about something about Jews and something about some mental disorder, she has that mental disorder. That's a guaranteed goddamn thing.
On which note, so that actually, I had already pulled this up, and that's a perfect segue for, like, maybe one to round this discussion out.
Speaking of goddamn, I'm starving. I am starving. I did not eat breakfast. I've got some leftover Mongolian beef downstairs.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Now I'm starving.
Well, I can't decide if I want to just heat it up as Mongolian beef or do my old breakfast thing, which is like, you know, scramble some eggs and then just throw some of the leftover meat, Mongolian beef, in with the eggs. Make a little Mongolian beef scramble.
That sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm starving. Yeah.
I am starving now. All right, keep going, though. Sorry.
No, I was just
going
to say, so you mentioned, like, if you see it, it's for you. So that's, like, probably the single most famous formulation of the last psychiatrist, who's a great, you know, blogger, highly recommended. You know, if you are not familiar with him, his blog, fortunately, is still up, and you can still go through the archives, and that's just something you should do.
Wait, who formulated that?
He didn't. I don't think he didn't come up with it, but he popularized it. The last psychiatrist. You don't know
the last psychiatrist? No. Yeah. I thought that was me.
You should. I think you'd find it a lot. You know, Borzoi is a big fan, and as am I. And I actually was
you learned. You, hey, the other discover day. New content every day.
Oh, he was great. He was sort of. It's an interesting like time period too, because he was blogging, I guess, from about 2010 to about 2014. So he stopped. Like as the awakening was started, Great Awakening was starting, but before Orange Man descended the Golden Staircase. So it was like a kind of, and I think he could sort of see the writing on the wall, because he's very much like, I suspect, you know, he's basically our guy nowadays, but he's mm-hmm. He's been doxed. I don't want to like repeat any of it, but he's like a medical doctor, practicing psychiatrist, and I imagine he just wants to, you know, quietly have his practice. But anyway, he has a great one of his. I mean, pretty much all his stuff is great. But he has a thing on the PTSD. It's called what is this? The military, the PTSD in Star Wars, the Star Wars guide. And he sort of using some scenes from Star Wars as a way of talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. Here's one of his points that I think speaks to this whole discussion quite well. He says, Marshall McLuhan once said, if everything around you is a nail, then get a really strong hammer. So the psychodynamic hammer. If narcissism is the exertion of will towards the maintenance of ego, trying to get everyone to see you the way you want to be seen and to get them to act the way you need them to act, then a narcissistic injury would be the discovery of the limitations of your own power. If the Americanized culture of the past two generations has deliberately encouraged narcissism as a positive personality structure, then we can expect higher rates of PTSD than in World War II, not because the physical stresses are more severe, in fact, they are most often less severe, but because the discovery of the limitations of our own power shock us more deeply than it shocked them. Typically, avoidance and flashbacks are the proxies for the diagnosis of PTSD, but these are drawn from experience with soldiers from a different time and a different culture. He was talking about paradigmatically about Vietnam, right? And, you know, the classic example of the Vietnam vet. Here's a firework and thinks it's Charlie in the bushes and, like, you know, has a panic attack. Today, the primary symptom of a traumatic reaction to the discovery of powerlessness wouldn't be fear, but rage. Hence, new onset domestic violence is more sensitive than nightmares. Being there, suddenly staring off in the distance, more specific than reliving the traumatic event. It follows that a PTSD soldier at home would be much less traumatized by a terrible car accident than by the suspicion that his wife is cheating. And the reason why I highlight, I mean, there's a whole lot of here, then we could just dig into this endlessly, and it's a really interesting passage, and he has a lot to say, but the reason why I bring it up is to note two things. Number one, he's identifying narcissism as the defining feature of American culture. I think obviously the connection between Jews and narcissism really speaks for itself. I don't think I need to elaborate much. And second, that he's identifying the primary symptom of the traumatic reaction to the discovery of powerlessness as rage, not fear, but rage. And so I think we can see in the anti-white rage that animates our enemies, and the discovery of their own powerlessness in the face of the Aryan man's waking up and taking power, is rage, right? Mm-hmm. That's the key defining feature of their psychological makeup over the past several years. Really, I mean, especially since Trump came and for the first time in generations gave white people, especially white men, a feeling of purpose, a feeling of power, a feeling that we can take our destiny into our own hands, has just been black bilious rage. And so, like, there's a direct connection here between, you know, the rage that's seething under the surface of this article and really every article in Tablet Magazine and the Jewish press generally, seething rage against white men and our, you know, they're discovering the limits of their power, their ability to control us. Their reaction mm-hmm. is rage. And this manifests as a form of you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and eating disorders. And so this is, there is a kind of way in which she's not wrong, right? Just completely obliquely.
Even separately, I feel like you can say, I mean, she's talking about how it's internally manifesting, but think about how ham-fisted they're getting. And we could say that they're just breeding a less clever generation of Jewish oligarchs and writers and tastemakers and all that. But part of it is maybe that kind of same rage where they're starting to realize that they've run up against some walls and this grift may not last much longer. I don't know.
Well, I think that, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is like, yeah, exactly right. Like they, you know, and that's why I started this on a note of optimism, which I genuinely am optimistic. Like they just, they're up against hard limits. You know, they're up against just reality itself fundamentally, and that's the you can't win that fight, not in the end, and not for very long. And they're discovering that more every day, and it enrages them.
Yep.
So anyway, okay. Yeah, that's probably enough on the anorexia and the Holocaust. It was one of these funny little, I was like, oh God, this is too good.
If there was ever a show to go a full hour deep dive on anorexia and the Holocaust, this would be it.
Indeed.
Well, I've got something, a little palate cleanser for you.
Absolutely. Hit me.
I feel like we could almost turn this into a game show, but I didn't really prep it that way. Oh God damn, what did my formatting thing here do? Turn this off. I'm looking through my notes. There is no group, single group that is as at once self-satisfied, smug, and entitled, and yet at the same time just breathtakingly incompetent, and let's just be honest, off-putting and ugly as black women. Like, say what you will about black men, if you get them in a one-on-one conversation, they're kind of going to probably admit that they're kind of a worthless piece of shit. Black women, just their sense of how important they are to the world and how important their presence is and how you are blessed is bottomless. And so I found this piece from, I guess she's not a published writer, but she has a Medium page and all that. So she writes at the quality of what I expect from black journalists. Like if you go read The Griot or The Root, you're going to get this. I mean, it's largely semi-literate. It, you know, it's one of those things where it's like the old, whose routine it was, you know, like just not, I was conjugating the elaboration of the notification of, you know, that kind of thing. Like they're just trying too hard, but her name's Marley Kay. It's a black woman and it's headlined 13 ways to easily tell if you're racist. I just went ahead and slapped my hand down. I was like, done. It's basically her writing and explaining. We all know the Kafka trap that they want to put even non-racist white people in, which is if you deny that you're racist, therefore you're racist. That's proof that you're racist. But I read this and I was like, if you can get past the horrible writing, she's right for the wrong reasons on much of what she has to say. So, skipping through her introduction, she says, number one, you still need a special not all white people disclaimer. If you read something on race or racism and you're immediately offended if the writer says white people, let me break some bad news to you. You're likely a big racist in need of developing your emotional intelligence.
Can I jump in for 1 second?
Yeah.
I'm now like professionally racist and it mm-hmm. no longer upsets me when I see one of these boons say white people.
Oh no!
You know what I mean? Like it's a particular kind of person who's actually kind of not racist that gets mm-hmm. upset at that.
Oh
just
yeah,
wanted to throw that in there.
And it's a particular kind of conservative that'll be
right.
Imagine exactly. If this were reversed. Imagine if I said this about black people. Well, why don't you? I mean, they're gonna say things about white people as a group. So why are you surrendering that ground? You know. Like they always say, well, what do you want to make everything about race? Well, how come you don't want to make anything about race, even when it's goddamn relevant? How about that? But anyway, she continues, white people all over America get away with doing or saying racist shit to black people every day, every single day, and they are perfectly okay with it, most times with zero consequences. Yeah. I mean, that stands to just, it's like she actually lives in a world. I honestly do believe that black people think that white people just get away with this. Like, you can just say nigger on the job. You can just, you know, talk about how you hate the Jews are ruining this country on your company email. Nothing happens. There's no consequences for racism. This is a racist system, for God's sakes. But they actually do believe that, I guess. And it's just kind of amusing because, I don't know. I don't know if it's a case of if when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, or if it's a case of this is our last fucking excuse. We are civilizationally incompetent, and we have no other excuse but to blame white. And if we lose that, we got to admit what we are. But, she continues. Number two, you need to tell black people how you feel when offended. Well, I also, as a professional racist, I really don't feel the need to ever tell black people anything. In fact, I try to avoid being in proximity to where I have to tell them something. But she says, you know, when we writers write about race, we had no clue you were going to read our piece and be offended because we said white people. So, a white person, are that white person who, again, her grammar's terrible, so I'm not just flubbing this like a stuttering retard. So, you, a white person, are that white person who thinks someone saying white people means you. Please know we may not know you personally. Your need to challenge us puts your racism on our radars. I certainly don't expect Sue or Mark to harass me on Instagram, Twitter, or here on my Medium for my personal thoughts and experiences on racism. We can change that. If you want. Anyway, if there are a significant number of truisms and commonalities among racists and the actions of racists, that's not my fault or problem. If white people are offended because the shoe fits them or their mama, don't come for me. Well, okay. I'm fine with that. And I'm fine with the heuristic I use, which goes back to I stay away. I don't want to be involved. I don't want to have to be in your presence. Don't ruin my day by being there. That's all I'm asking. And here's number three. This is one where I said, okay, the first two were just her usual, you know, or just usual black complaints. But this one is great. You live in an all-white neighborhood. First off, ask yourself, why do you live where you live? Because it's an all-white neighborhood. Done and answered. No, but she's not wrong that you are racist if you live in an all-white neighborhood. And who do we always find are the most likely to live in all-white neighborhoods? Particularly, they will pay the premium for the gate. They will pay for the extra. It's liberals. It's left wing. It's shit libs. It's libtards. They are no different than white supremacists or, whatever. They are no different than those that they say that they hate, us fascists, us white supremacists and all that, in their living habits. They move to as wide an area as they can afford. Period. So if she says that people who do that are racist, okay, fine. Let's just get those people to admit it, and, you know, therefore we have new recruits, I guess. I don't know. She says, you have fetishes for good, in quotes, shit.
Yeah, I have to say, well, yeah, sorry. I mean, this is just like...
This is where we are really getting into it now. Excellent schools, good clothing, the best communities, the best restaurants, the finest blah, blah, blah. All that is code for white people shit. Let's make this perfectly clear.
Where's the lie?
Exactly. Every liberal who says, I want my kid to go to a good school, or, oh, why did you move 30 miles from downtown when you work downtown? Oh, I just wanted to live in a good neighborhood.
Well, I don't
know what you're saying. We know what you're saying. They know what you're saying. Everybody knows what you're saying.
It's true, but I think she's saying something more like, she's saying just when she says it later in this thing, good is all about whiteness and white standards of good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I guess she's trying to say, like, you know, black people can do, but everybody knows, like, if black people do something, it's going to be shitty, or at least shittier than if the white people do the same thing. Like that, duh. You know, I mean, this is what I was saying. It was an aside yesterday. I was talking with Lewis. You know, I basically, my earliest red pill, or one of them, was basically talking about, you know, like getting accused ultimately of, like, you know, the idea that having standards is white supremacy, that the idea that there's an objective truth, or that there's a you know, standards of good and of bad, or, you know, even of aesthetic value, is white supremacist, and eventually having, you know, falling back into the position of, yeah, well, fine. You know, I mean, like, if you want to say that that objective truth and goodness and you know, the sublime art, that these are all like white constructs, and that goes hand in hand with white supremacy. You know, initially I was like, well, I was fighting against that. And now I'm like, you know what? Fine. You're right. Because it's not just about, like, yes, there's this coded language aspect of, you know, good schools. We all know what that means, but it's also just, you know, white people collectively make good things, objectively good things. And the concept of objective goodness is what they're reacting against.
And they're talking about this like it's a pre-existing thing. Like, again, it's that African mindset where you can't understand cause and effect or time on a linear scale, where it's like, well, this is a bad school. Well, why is it a bad school? Well, it's trashy. The windows are all broken. You had to put bars up. There's, you know, violence every afternoon in the playground. 20 kids have been suspended in the last 3 weeks. Okay. So is it the physical property that makes it a bad school, or the kids that are there? And at this good school,
right,
is it the physical property, or is it that the kids there don't engage
magic dirt versus tragic dirt? Right.
Yeah. Like, is it that the dirt or magic?
And yeah.
And in fact, if I dig deeper, we find out it's like some of the worst school districts in America, like the Washington DC public school district, has the highest per capita spending in the United States. And the worst performance and all the violence and all that crap. So again, it's not about the money. It's not about the physical facility. Good schools are good because the white kids are there, and then the Asian kids and such. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. But they don't understand that. They don't understand that it's a good neighborhood because you're not there. it's a nice restaurant because you're not talking loudly into your cell phone and smacking on ribs and demanding extra straws for your strawberry daiquiri. That's why it's good. And that's what we want. And you admit that, you know, we just want to go have these things that are good for us. And you just demand to be in there, that you will go into debt to try to move into these neighborhoods. And she says, for white folks, good means away from black folks. And I'm like, okay, so why can't we have that? Who says that you have the right to be amongst us? If we want to have our thing over here, you go have your thing over there. No one's interfering with you, but, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's somehow it's the magic dirt. It's the magic building. It's the magic spaces. Is there anything else in that
one? Just goes on and on and on, yeah, about basically.
But like, I guess the bigger truth in that particular point, though, is it's true. This is why white liberals lie about race, because they move to those neighborhoods, they move to those schools, they buy those homes, they give as they move to as wide an area as they can.
Well, this is why I wish. I mean, her thing is, you know, she's just like basically like you want to live around white people, you want to enjoy white people's stuff, you want to, you know, you want to stick up for white people, you know, you don't want to consider yourself one of the bad whites, etc. Like the kind of person she's talking to, which I guess theoretically is the kind of white person who'd be reading. I thought this was The Root. I guess it's a Medium post, but I guess it's getting like play or so. It's like 2,400 clapbacks. So there you go. Anyway. I mean, like we all know this message. We all know the kinds of people who are pushing this kind of a message. This is a place where it's like, I wish there were a way for us to step into the conversation and tell the white person, the white liberal who's getting berated like this, you know what? She's right. You know, she's right. She's calling you a racist, and you maybe want to think to yourself as, you know, enlightened. And that means that you have to bend over backwards, but it's never going to be enough. You're never going to satisfy these people, and the solution is not to like bend over harder and to move into the ghetto or something, because then that's gentrification too. I'm sure. Anyway,
yeah. If you could ever corner a shit lib and explain to them how, you know, the whole thing about, oh, so you want to move into these neighborhoods because you want to experience the urban thing, and you can explain to them that they're a gentrifier and therefore the blacks don't like them, and then they say, well, I don't see skin color, I'm colorblind, and you say, you know what? They consider you even more racist than me. I will call them, you know, certain words to their face, and yet they'll respect me more than you, because you are actually lying to them when you say you don't see color. And the way the software freezes up on an honest shitlib's face when you get that across is, it's a magic moment.
Because
then they're all like, well, I need to rethink this whole thing. Like, yeah. It's just not going to get along. And then she goes into, you have no black friends or black kids, which, whatever. No, I mean, people, again, like they point out on Tedious a lot, the reason that they have to focus on cop violence on blacks is because there's not much white on black violence, because for the most part, white people try to avoid being around blacks to begin with at all times. And, you know, you might be around your talented 10th, your creative class talented 10th that might be at your work. He's a good guy, he's white presenting.
everybody knows the score. Come on. Let's just all stop lying. Black people still apparently believe the workplace is racist and that everything, microaggressions, all that stuff, that white people cover up for white people. Your politics is all about white people shit. If only she lies there, because as we know, white people, the last thing that they generally want to do is to advocate their own interest. And that's one of the things that scares them the most, and the thing that we have to get people over. Because once that happens, once, and that's what the Jews are scared of right now with the CRT going too far, critical race theory, is that white people will start seeing themselves as a group. And once you see yourself as a group amongst other groups, your natural instinct is, how may I protect this group? How can I advance the interests of this group? Because it benefits me. Not this, this bullshit deracinated, well, we're all just individuals. I don't see a race. Sorry, I just wanted to burn through the rest of this because I'm about running out of steam myself. If your answer to interacting with black and brown folks is escalating, if your first thought when engaging with black people is to provoke them, boss them, intimidate them, guilt them, harass them, or call the police on them, you are a flaming fucking racist, diabolical, demonic racist to the 10th power. You need Jesus, Buddha, white sage baths, an exorcism, and probably those ass whoopings your parents never gave you. Racist white people have a terrible habit of escalating and being manipulative. Really? Really? We're the ones who are escalating this stuff. We're the ones causing the chimp outs. Okay. We're having the chimp outs, not causing them. Even when black folks come in peace, citation needed, most white people aren't happy until we leave in tears, in fear, in handcuffs, or in a coffin. No comment. They need to see black and brown people in pain. The need to see black and brown people in pain is racist, and it's another one of those covert ways which black people use, white people use their white privilege to maintain their racist social order. White folks unnecessarily escalating with black and brown people is terrorism. I honestly cannot think of a single one of the videos of the Karens or of the any of these incidents or any of the Black Lives Matter riots or anything where the provocateur was white. You may fact check me. Do you remember any, DK?
No, and of course, the attempt to call it terrorism is itself a form of terrorism, right?
Yeah. Well,
like using the language of terrorism, you know, like if you, if you, if you're being assaulted, you call the police, that's terrorism according to them, which is terrorizing you out of calling the police when you're being assaulted.
Well, and just asking for the manager because you're getting shitty service. That's terrorism. That's an assault on black people. Advocating for basic minimum standards for the fulfillment of the social contract. Dude, that's so fucking racist. Here's one of my favorites. Because black people are exhausted. You know? Do you hear that phrase a lot?
I'm so tired. I'm just so tired.
I've been dealing with white people all day, and I'm just exhausted. Don't ask me to explain racism to you. Her number 12 is requiring black folks provide proof and literary citations to help your understanding means you're racist. So basically, I guess that kind of speaks for itself. Do I have to explain that one? I mean, they can assert whatever they want. If you say, hey, really? Did black people really land on the moon in 478 AD? Okay. Where'd you get that? Races! But it just goes to the lowering standards. And again, if you look at this as a bigger picture, I'm not sitting here outrage pointing this particular article. In fact, I was like laughing and agreeing with so much of it. But use this as a insight into the black mind. This is a semi-educated, supposedly, she says she has a degree of some sort, black woman who's pretty prolific. She writes a lot. She seems to be in touch with what black people are talking about in the political sphere to the degree that it's there. I mean, she's hitting all the usual points. And I'm sort of taken with the idea, though, that she does represent the average black academic or the average black, I'm really hesitant to use the word intellectual. You know what I'm trying to say? The intellectual cargo cultist? You know what I'm saying? Like, I got the degree. I make these statements. I have published paper. I is, academic. I think that her mindset is this. And then you go into this and it's like,
the total inversion of even the most basic standards of argumentation, scholarship, whatever you want to call this. I think that that's really where, because we as a society, as a white Western society, in reconciliation for our white privilege and for all our past sins, we have to meet somewhere in the middle with the great unwashed brown horde. And what that requires is they can't raise up to our standards. So therefore, we must lower it to to theirs. And so if you want to know the future of black excellence in education, really, I feel like this particular item, number 12, requiring black folks to even provide proof, I think that's where we're going. And I'm sanguine about that. I mean, when I found out Harvard, a black guy got a degree from Harvard for a mixtape that he created.
Yeah.
I knew then at that point, I no longer had to view Harvard and anyone coming out of it or anything coming out of it as a serious institution. Now, you can imagine what my view of historically black colleges and universities and black affirmative action degrees is, or it was before this. But now that I'm thinking this is where we're going, I don't even have to have any pretense. It's like it's like a free ride. It's just, again, confirmation bias. It hits the veins and it just, ugh. Makes you want to see that dead baby crawling on the ceiling like train spotting. I don't know where I was going with that. Actually, that was a terrible analogy. Anyway. Oh, that was a bad time for your baby to cry out.
Yeah, I actually think I got to go.
This got dark.
Do we have any further... do we have anything else? Or I mean,
I got guess nothing else. More, I mean...
I did want to say briefly that press F for Japan. No, I mean they seem to be doing okay, but the full court press from the international Zionist media is quite disturbing, and I guess it could have been worse because they held off on some of the messaging, but they still had this horrible Shibun, I guess, like half Japanese, this tennis player light the flame, and they're just making the whole thing about there was an article in the New York Times in the news section about black girl magic at the Olympics. It's not an opinion piece. It was like all about how the Olympics are celebrate black girl magic, but they don't properly respect black. It's just the whole thing is just absurd. So, but I mean, fortunately, they're the Japanese people seem to be, kind of over it. They're kind of embarrassed. I saw other articles in the New York the Wall Street Journal rather about how Toyota actually pulled advertising within Japan, because basically the Olympics are so unpopular with the Japanese people, and it's looking like it's going to be a massive, massive financial hole for them. So anyway, I guess they dodged a bullet, or they mostly dodged a bullet, but it's still, they're getting hit with the propaganda, and they were forced to they have the I guess there were this guy who made this Holocaust joke 25 years, which is I never
it was in a skit.
They were talking about it on TDS, and I didn't quite from what I could tell, it wasn't even like a Holocaust joke per se. It wasn't like they were like joking about the Holocaust. It was just like the Holocaust was the subject matter within some kind of
they were doing some kind of a bit where it was like a dad word pun play. Like, I couldn't even come up with an example of how it would be in English, but like where it's like if you and I had this like set up routine where it's like I have some like well, that would be a contrafibularity, and you'd be like, no, a fibularity would be a singularity that has lying to itself. I'd be like, no, you can't lie on a singular. I mean, where you continue to like back and forthing. And it's just about wordplay. It has nothing to do with any. And so they, because there's some word or expression that sounds something like, the equivalent of Japanese of Holocaust, they work that into their little routine. And, 20 years ago, and now the guy's fired. They're coming for you.
Yeah, and
it's
so
never enough. I mean, it's never enough for these people.
And yeah, and Japan is they're starting the trickle of the thing. Anyway, I think I gotta go.
Yeah. No problem, man. Thank you so much. This has been a great
thank
episode.
You. Yeah, of course.
I'll get all the plugs in, and you go take care of that.
I'll do my plug real quick.
Future King.
The main thing is the we have a new episode of Culture Terror, as I mentioned on Harry Potter. We had a good discussion, and. I hope you all enjoy. So take care, everybody.
Thank you so much, DK. Let me get the plugs in here, Frank, and we'll get out of here. I want to thank all the live listeners that came out today. All of you, go to national-justice.com. I don't know that there's a day that Eric Stryker doesn't break a big story. Go to dissident-mag.com for a lot of great long-form journalism from the same people who bring you Fash the Nation. Go to nationaljusticeparty.com. They will tell you what to think and where to send your money. I'm kidding. AntelopeHillPublishing.com. They are producing the very best content out of our thing. Go there, support them, buy every book twice. That's what I think. That way you can read one, mark it up, and then you can have another one to put on your bookshelf to make people think you actually have something more than a grug brain. Borzoi's Hyper Podcastism with Marty, our favorite content producer, Marty Phillips, is available on the TRS Radio Network site. Let me see if there's anything else I need to get to here. I'm kind of doing this on the fly. I guess that's it. Therightstuff.biz/paywall to get behind the paywall for premium content. And that's it for this week. Frank, remember, pleased to be closing ticket to Paris, Judah, and long be living to Europa. Mr. Producer, hail victory. See ya, Kyle. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.